Hello, and welcome to MCNC Community Connect, a podcast where leaders and innovators regularly meet to discuss some of today's hottest technology topics and trends. I'm James Nestor, Chief Marketing Officer and Senior Director of Client Advocacy at MCNC. And today we have an important and timely conversation for you focused on the latest updates surrounding the Universal Service Fund, E-Rate, and the upcoming ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm joined by four incredible guests for this conversation, including Phil Eamer, MCNC's Vice President of Business Development, Jen Leisure, President and CEO of The Quilt, a national coalition that represents research and education networks like MCNC all across the nation, Ray Zeiss, Senior Director of the Technology Infrastructure Lab at the Friday Institute, which is part of NC State University, helping to advance K-12 education in North Carolina through innovation in teaching, learning, and leadership. And last but not least, Kristen Cora, Policy Counsel to Schools, Health, and Libraries Broadband Coalition, better known as SHELBY, a nonprofit advocacy organization dedicated to closing the digital divide in the United States. Thank you for joining me, everyone. Welcome to the show. We have a lot to unpack today, so let's get started. The Universal Service Fund, USF, which includes the E-Rate program, is currently facing a significant challenge at the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of FCC versus Consumers Research. It's an important case that has the potential to upend a significant source of technology funding for school systems throughout the country. The case, which is set to be decided this month, will decide the constitutionality of the USF, a program established under the Telecommunications Act of 1996 to fund the E-Rate program and promote universal access to telecommunications services. The court's ruling in this case is a high-stakes microcosm for future generations. But before we get into the significance of this case and its potential impact across the country, let's take a step back and paint the picture so we better understand what the USF is, its purpose, structure, and programs like E-Rate. So I'm going to start with you, Phil. If you could give us first that historical perspective.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate being on the podcast. So the Universal Service Fund, as you pointed out, was created in, I guess, technically in 1997, but it was directed to be created by Congress in the Telecom Act of 96. I think it's probably useful to go back to even a little bit further, right, to 1934, which is when the FCC was created. And that was kind of the initial Communications Act, right, that's set in place this notion that everybody should have access to wired and wireless communications in the U.S. And so that started in 34. Back then, it was the idea was that it's really a logical monopoly. And so AT&T was in charge, right? So AT&T was really the only provider to have responsibility for building this particularly wired communications infrastructure. Then 60 years later, right, the Telecom Act comes out. And it's important to understand that the Telecom Act, while E-Rate, establishing the Universal Service Fund, and E-Rate as part of that, was a substantial part of it, deregulation was also a big part of it. And so a lot of what happened after the Telecom Act included things like a lot of consolidation of things like cable companies, but also the emergence of this notion of competitive local exchange carriers. So I think it's important to understand that there was a lot of other things that were happening in the Telecom Act that were going to uproot and change the way telecom worked at the same time we were trying to figure out how to make telecom services more accessible, right? And so now, what does that look like with the Universal Service Fund? So the Universal Service Fund is established per the act. The Universal Service Administrative Company was created as a not-for-profit to administer it, meaning to both collect the universal service fees and to sort of manage the administration of these underlying programs, which include the one that we are all is near and dear to our hearts, of course, the E-Rate program that covers providing access to for schools and libraries. There's a rural healthcare program that had a similar goal. The Lifeline or Lifeline Link-Up program, which was about providing subsidies to individuals, particularly low-income individuals, to help them with their phone and internet services. And again, that's called Lifeline because in the days of phone lines, which again in 1996, even internet access was primarily delivered via phone lines. It was considered a quote lifeline service. Simply put, when the power went out, you still had dial tone, right? And so the idea is you're supposed to be able to dial 911. And then the final sort of piece of the program, USF program here, is the high cost program, which post the National Broadband Plan, meaning post 2011, created the Connect America Fund. And so that is really subsidies to service providers to be able to provide access in areas, particularly rural areas, where it's particularly expensive to build.
Thank you, Phil. I think it's important to recall the history. And I think I really appreciate the perspective of going back all the way back to the 30s, right? Because I think a lot of folks forget about that and the origins of this and why this came about and why this is so important all those decades later. Kristen, could you give us a quick overview of E-Rate?
Absolutely. Thanks, Jim. And thanks, Phil, for that wonderful overview. So as Phil said, the E-Rate program is one of the four federally supported programs under the Universal Service Fund. The purpose of the program here is to provide funding discounts to help K-12 schools and libraries have affordable access to telecommunications and internet services. So there are two categories of service that an eligible school or library can request for funding here. So first we have Category 1 services. This includes telecommunications, telecommunication services, and internet access. And then second, we have Category 2 services. These are the services that deliver internet access within schools and libraries. So examples here would be internal connections, basic maintenance of those internal connections, and managed internal broadband services. So every year, the FCC releases what's called an eligible services list. And as the name would suggest, it provides guidance about the types of equipment and services that are eligible for E-Rate support. Now, as I said at the top, E-Rate is a discount program. So this means that it doesn't pay for 100% of services that a school or library needs. So instead, the amount of the discount that an eligible school or library receives is dependent on both the level of poverty and whether it's located in an urban or rural area. And so depending on these factors, an applicant's discount could range from 20% to 90% of the costs of eligible services. And the total amount of funding under the E-Rate program is based on demand. And so each year the FCC establishes an overall program funding cap. Back in March of this year, the FCC announced that the E-Rate program's annual cap for funding year 2025 is about $5.06 billion. And that's up from 2024 to include an adjustment for inflation. So now putting aside the technicalities of the program, E-Rate is really a critical source for so many communities. Not only does this funding enable schools and libraries to maintain the kinds of tech needed to provide digital learning, but it also helps economically disadvantaged areas in rural and urban locations where internet services might otherwise be unavailable. So as we'll get into this here at the podcast, the E-Rate program and the broader Universal Service Fund are at a critical juncture right now in the courts. We're pending a decision from the Supreme Court related to a question about the USF's constitutionality, and that outcome could have significant ramifications for the funding of these telecommunications and internet services for schools, libraries, rural areas, and low-income communities nationwide.
Thank you, Kristen. I really appreciate that context around E-Rate. So now that we have a better picture of USF and E-Rate from Phil and Kristen, let's talk for a minute about the impact in the real world. And so I'm going to go to you, Ray. Can you elaborate a little bit on the progress that we've made in North Carolina in recent years in particular touching on the success we've seen with the North Carolina School Connectivity Initiative.
Sure. Nice to talk to you all today. So the School Connectivity Initiative has been around for approaching almost 20 years. I was not here for the beginning, but I've been doing data analysis and planning for about a decade on the School Connectivity Initiative. It specifically focuses on public schools in the state of North Carolina. So there are other E-rate recipients, but it is run by our state's Department of Education, which is known as the Department of Public Instruction. It is appropriated funds that are leveraged against the E-rate program. So there are a few states in the nation that do this, not many, but we as a state pay for the non-E-rate portion for school connectivity, whether it's the internet, the WAN, or even the Category 2. And so it's possible that a district doesn't have to use any local funds to get reliable high-speed internet in the state of North Carolina. We pay up to the FCC budget cap on the $157, $167, I think, per student over the 5 years. And we hope to continue doing that next year when the budget bumps up to $201 because of inflation adjustment. So in aggregate, since the beginning of the E-rate program, public schools have been dispersed $1.4 billion in the state of North Carolina. So that's a significant amount of money. And there's a huge uptick when modernization happened in the 2015 E-rate cycle and all schools became eligible for the Wi-Fi to the classroom program known as Category 2. We call it Wi-Fi to every classroom. And we were able to ensure fiber to every school and Wi-Fi in every classroom around 2018 in North Carolina, which was a major accomplishment for the state. And all of that was due to successful planning at the state agency, the Department of Public Instruction, and the use of E-rate and the effort of many people down at the individual school districts who actually had to do the legwork to implement.
Thanks, Ray. Appreciate that. Now let's take a second, if we could, want to get into a little bit of a legal deep dive. The legal challenge to the USF's funding mechanism was initiated by Consumers Research, which questioned the constitutionality of the fees levied on telecom carriers. So while previous federal appeals courts, including the Sixth and Eleventh Circuits, had upheld the program against similar challenges, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals took a different stance. In a significant ruling in July of 2024, the Fifth Circuit, by a 9-7 vote, declared the USF's funding mechanism unconstitutional. The Fifth Circuit's decision rested on two primary conclusions. First, that Congress had impermissibly delegated too much authority to the FCC, and that the FCC had in turn improperly ceded excessive power to USAC, a private entity responsible for administering the fund. A pivotal aspect of the Fifth Circuit's reasoning was its determination that the USF contributions constituted a tax rather than a fee, which under Article 1 of the US Constitution, the power to levy taxes is exclusively vested in the legislative branch, which led the court to conclude that the FCC and USAC lacked the requisite authority to impose such a charge. So given the circuit court's split created by this ruling, the Supreme Court granted review and heard arguments back in March. So I think it's safe to say at this point, we are really all in this together. So Jen, as a representative of the Quilt, which supports more than 40 research and education networks across the country, what's the best case scenario here from your view?
So it's a pleasure to be here with you today. If the court upholds the Fifth Circuit's decision, E-rate will face substantial uncertainty. Unless the funding mechanism is restructured in a way that complies with the Constitution. This could impact ongoing and planned technology projects nationwide, with severe impacts on library schools and school systems that rely on the program for access to discounted internet and telecommunications services. The Quilt's position is that it's imperative that these programs remain consistently funded and supported without interruption. Quilt members, who are all nonprofit networking organizations across the country, connect tens of thousands of schools and libraries. Many members of the Quilt are involved and participate in E-Rate either as service providers or as consortia filers. If the Supreme Court upholds the Fifth Circuit's decision, then there's a risk of potential disruption to the USF programs. And this could be disastrous for the schools, libraries, and other USF programs, including the rural healthcare sites. It's possible that the Supreme Court doesn't uphold the Fifth Circuit's decision in its entirety. It may say that parts of the USF are unconstitutional and those parts get struck down. And that would require Congress to take action to address these certain aspects. If that's the case, I'd expect that Congress may look to further define program requirements and metrics to address those areas that the Supreme Court could call out in its ruling.
Jen, I appreciate that. We, as a member of the Quilt, appreciate your leadership and certainly appreciate the national perspective and your work to support all the other members of the Quilt. Phil and Kristen, the Supreme Court's impending decision obviously carries profound implications for the Universal Service Fund, E-Rate, and the broader administrative state. Could you summarize the stakes of the case, Phil, if the Supreme Court upholds the USF?
I think in that case, I mean, all is pretty good. I think if we can dodge that bullet, I would say that as the person who started the School Connectivity Initiative that Ray talked about near 2 decades ago, we actually thought about this even then, right? Because this discussion about the constitutionality and the other details about the sort of contribution factor and so forth have been topics that have come up pretty much every Congress, certainly since I've been in the E-Rate universe. And so I think even if the ruling kind of goes in favor of not twiddling with USF right now, I suspect the argument won't go away. And folks will continue to sort of jump on that, if not every year, certainly every administration. And so I think that because of that, it's incumbent upon folks like us in North Carolina, school districts, consortia that are in a sense relying on E-Rate to be diligent in how we get it funded and make sure that the, in the case of North Carolina, our legislators understand sort of what's at stake. Because at the end of the day, I don't think you can turn it off. I think what will happen is the burden of where the funding comes on will change. And so North Carolina is already putting in a good bit of funding. You know, does that get pushed down even further to locals? Do you need state level universal service funds, that kind of stuff? So again, I think it would be, it's a sigh of relief for a minute. But I think the fact that you've now even gotten it to a First Circuit or Fifth Circuit decision just means that we need to even work harder to make sure that everyone properly understands at the state and federal and local level what's going on and what the implications would be.
I think that's a really important perspective there, Phil. Appreciate you sharing that. And then Kristen, conversely, if the Supreme Court strikes down the USF, what are the stakes of the case there? What's the impact there?
Well, this is definitely the million-dollar question. And the answer here really does depend on what route the Supreme Court takes. So it's hard to predict exactly what might happen here. At the start, I do want to point out a distinction between what the judges focused on at the Fifth Circuit and what the justices focused on later at the Supreme Court. So the Fifth Circuit analyzed the non-delegation issue here in a couple of ways. So one being whether Congress unconstitutionally delegated its legislative authority to the FCC by allowing the agency, rather than Congress, to determine the amount of money that telecommunications providers would contribute to the USF, without any constraints on the agency's discretion. And the other being whether the FCC improperly delegated administrative authority of the USF to USAC, a private entity, especially when it comes to setting the quarterly contribution factor. So we have these two different issues that were presented to the Fifth Circuit. The decision that came down from the Fifth Circuit was based on a combination theory of double delegation, meaning that with both of these non-delegation issues at play, they determined that the USF was unconstitutional. Now, during the oral argument at the Supreme Court, however, the justices didn't seem to really agree that this combination theory applied here. They were a little bit more skeptical about that, and they asked very few questions about the delegation of administrative authority to USAC, to that second non-delegation issue. So instead, the Supreme Court looked more closely at the first thread regarding the FCC's own statutory authority to determine what gets paid into the fund. And we really saw 2.5 hours, essentially, of the justices going back and forth about whether the language of the text provided clear and specific guidelines to the agency on this point. So it does seem unlikely that we would see a Supreme Court decision that would affirm based on the combination theory that we saw from the Fifth Circuit. Now, regarding outcomes, many of the justices expressed concern about the effect or impact of their decision. So during oral argument, we heard questions about the effect on both the people that benefit from the USF and the effect on the court's other decisions. And I think this is noteworthy because it shows that the justices seemingly recognize the importance and significance of real-world impact here, outside of just strictly analyzing the legal arguments related to statutory authority and non-delegation. Regarding the effect on beneficiaries of the USF, when Shelby intervened in the Fifth Circuit back in 2022, we specifically focused our arguments on how affirming this challenge would not only disrupt the communications sector and pull the rug out from under anchor institutions, but how it would affect the millions of consumers that rely on the telecommunications services provided by the fund. So if the statute were to be overturned completely, it would require congressional review and, you know, potentially threaten to abruptly cut off educational institutions, libraries, healthcare providers, businesses, and consumers who depend on universal service for vital communication services today. And a couple of examples of this, I would say, are schools and libraries that receive E-rate funding may no longer be able to afford broadband connectivity that they currently rely on, or they might face higher fees to access telecommunication services. And any of these kinds of changes could ultimately undermine their educational mission. And relatedly, I know we're focusing mostly on E-rate, but if you look at the rural healthcare program, for example, many healthcare providers serving rural areas are able to afford modern telecommunications and internet services only because of the rural healthcare program. So any disruption to the USF could risk the health and well-being of many Americans out there. And also, companies that have invested in networks and facilities to serve schools and libraries and healthcare providers, you know, that participate in E-rate and rural healthcare could be left in unsustainable financial positions and potentially disrupt their service contracts. Now, outside of just overturning the statute completely, we could see a situation where the courts uphold the text entirely, which would be great. Or some of the justices might take issue with certain parts that perhaps it wants Congress to remove. So, for example, during the oral argument, there was some line of questioning about the FCC's ability to identify new principles related to universal service. So we could see a situation where some justices could agree that the text is constitutional as long as that provision is removed, and other examples like that.
Wow, really appreciate that perspective and that overview, Kristen. That's really helpful. So As I mentioned before, we're coming up on decision time, we think, right? We expect a decision in this case to come from the Supreme Court later this month. As we await that ruling, many are cautiously optimistic that the court will uphold USF's legality, but as Phil alluded to, the program's financial stability is another issue. So before we go into the discussion of reform possibilities and USF's current funding mechanism, let's put into some real terms what we just talked about, meaning what does it look like to each of you if the court strikes down the USF? So I'll start with you, Ray. How much money does North Carolina stand to lose?
So this is actually a very interesting question. And I will say, if you haven't listened to the Supreme Court, it's only an hour argument. It's very fascinating. There's no black and white answer, right? It is all gray. And the justices all raise some very interesting questions. And I think they have a tough decision because the implications, not just to the FCC, but to and many other agencies could be impacted. In terms of North Carolina, we received in, I guess, fiscal year 23, which is the last year we have a report from the USF. We about broke even, meaning the amount of money we paid as North Carolina residents was $189 million in contributions to the USF. And what we took back in disbursements was $187 million. That's even, basically. In previous years, we were only getting about 75% back. So we've either reduced the amount we're paying in or we've increased the amount we're taking out over time to move from a net exporter of USF funds of 25% to being breaking even. So speaking specifically for North Carolina, if USF were to disappear tomorrow, our recommendation would be to raise the North Carolina telecom tax by 50 cents or so. A de minimis amount, and then redirect those funds from the general fund to school connectivity, as well as some other programs we may need to stand up in our broadband office to help offset and ensure universal access. We can't forget that, the high cost program is a large portion of USF, and there is a $42 billion BEAD program waiting in the wings to be deployed, of which $1.5 billion will be coming to North Carolina. So possibly the need for the high cost program should subside over time, leaving the other three programs more money possibly. I would say some other states will not do so well. I think Alaska, for every dollar they put in, they get $27 in USF. New York, for every dollar they put in, they get 30 cents back. So the states that are net exporters of USF probably we'll figure out ways to collect the money a different way. I think the simple fix is for Congress to, simple in quotes, is to just call it a tax, dictate what is going to be taxed, what the funds can be used for, what the cap is, and move on and not have to have a massive reform of not just FCC fees, but fees in many other different agencies. I'm not a lawyer, but I would say after hearing the court case, I could imagine we could ask whether or not the national parks are allowed to charge you a fee to come into the park. So I'm curious to see what the results are, but I don't have an opinion one way or the other or how it might go. I just want to make sure that we're prepared to build the business case for how we would recover the funds if we needed to in North Carolina.
It's a really good point. Really good point. And Jen, obviously, Ray's talking about the North Carolina perspective and a few other states, but can you give us the national perspective in terms of the impact or the effect this will have on other research and education networks across the nation?
Sure, yes. So Quilt members, per their nonprofit missions, provide services to only community anchor institutions. So first, I want to qualify my comments on your question, that they're going to be focused on the impact of any changes to USF specifically on these institutions. If it happens that the Supreme Court strikes down USF in its entirety, Congress will need to act swiftly to reauthorize or restructure the funding mechanism to preserve these critical services. This could involve passing new legislation that clearly defines the scope and administration of universal service programs, ensuring compliance with constitutional requirements. If that's the case, We could be facing immediate funding shortfalls, jeopardizing services for millions of Americans. Should the court uphold the Fifth Circuit's decision, we aren't just talking about ripple effects for a few schools or libraries or rural healthcare sites in certain areas. We're talking about shockwaves across the country impacting millions of students, library patrons, and rural citizens. If they're no longer able to afford connections to the internet and are cut off from access to digital resources that are vital to the work and to their role in their communities, then we're going to be setting back our communities and our citizens back, decades in terms of technology and access to vital services. Really taking our country a step backwards significantly in terms of education, healthcare access, workforce development, productivity, and digital citizenship. So, it is, as my colleagues here have said, this is a really important case with really significant consequences.
Yeah, so Kristen, how might community anchor institutions react to this or be impacted by this?
Right, Jim. So I would just reiterate again that any disruption to the USF could have a devastating effect on anchor institutions, service providers, and others that participate in the program, but also to millions of Americans that benefit from the telecommunication services that they receive. Shelby conducted a DC fly-in earlier this year, and our members brought countless of examples to Congress about how the USF programs provide real-world impact to Americans nationwide, across educational endeavors, healthcare access, and digital resources that help people participate in today's modern society.
Very good. Phil, I gotta ask, was the possibility of E-rate going away on your radar screen in 2006, 2007, when you were a part of developing the school connectivity plan?
Yes. So, in a word, so when we started the planning for school connectivity, there was both knowledge that, again, even then, near two decades ago, that folks in DC, there were certain members of Congress that were kind of poking at the Universal Service Fund, but also locally, there are certain parts of the state, certain school districts that were like, well, I don't know if it's something that could go away. Do we want to build an entire program that's wrapped around, this essentially what looks like a federal subsidy? Even though it's a discount program, to be clear, school districts see it as funding. So it's like, if you're a tech director in a school district, E-rate is a funding line in your budget, right? And so even though technically speaking, right, we know that E-rate is actually a discount program and it's a reimbursement program and all of that, to school districts is funding. So, all of this with, came into the room and was part of our planning process. And I'll go a little further, and I think that, as I mentioned earlier, I think no matter what happens with the Supreme Court here, I think we will, in North Carolina, continue to dig into, what would we do or should we do to shore up school connectivity so it goes for another 20 years, right? And some of one of I'll bring up one thing that we thought about back in the beginning was, well, if you look at the key things we're trying to fund, and at that time it was pre Category One, Category Two. So at that time, most of what was funded was connectivity between schools and connectivity to the internet. Okay, now we've added this Category Two function, which includes Wi-Fi, essentially, the connectivity inside the school. One of the things we considered back then was, should we really just focus on state funds to pay the non-discount share for the WAN? And then should we treat access to the internet separately in the state? Because in what we do in North Carolina is kind of a state-level consortium. that provides internet access to all school districts, or access to the internet through the MCNC backbone. And so we thought even near 20 years ago about should we make that split, and you a little bit hedge your bets, right? And so now it's even more complicated because you've got Category 2, and the amount there. I don't recall whether Ray said this, but in North Carolina, it's the connectivity funding from the state on an annual basis is, let's call it somewhere between 35 and 40 million a year. So it's a pretty substantial nut. So anyway, that's a long way of saying yes, we absolutely thought about it when we started the school connectivity initiative, and we kind of figured, well, let's optimize how we interact with the program and react as the program changes. And we reacted when it was modernized in 2014, 2015, and I suspect we will continue to react. The program is built in such a way that it allows us to do that.
Just to be clear, in North Carolina last year, there was $21 million in appropriated dollars for the state portion, and against $75 million in E-rate disbursements for North Carolina. And that roughly stays around that $100 million mark every year.
Certainly significant. Appreciate you all's thoughts on that. Kristen and Jen, real fast, I want to ask you, if the court affirms the constitutionality of the USF, should we assume it's business as usual, or is that dangerous given what you all heard from members of Congress during your recent fly-in? So, Jen, do you want to start with that? And then, Kristen, your perspective as well?
So, being able to continue USF is what we hope is the court's outcome here. And business as usual. We hope that as the programs continue to evolve, thinking positively about the outcome of the court, if the programs continue and are allowed to evolve, it would be great to, in the future have us include some additional, facets and adapt to new technologies. For example, the E-rate program currently is piloting support for cybersecurity, which we know is one of the largest challenges that schools and libraries face in some of their day-to-day activities. It would be great to see this pilot succeed with a strong future and strong foundation and support for these programs and potentially become a permanent facet of the E-rate program down the road.
And Kristen, your thoughts?
Sure. So, yes, of course, affirming the constitutionality of the USF would be great news. We've heard from a lot of folks that are very concerned about the USF's future in connection with the Consumers Research case. So, a situation where there is no disruption to USF support would absolutely provide a sigh of relief. However, I do agree that there could be question about whether future challenges would be cast upon the program. And then to your question about, what we've been hearing in Congress, there has been some work initiated by Congress to look at the programs individually. How are they running? Could there be changes made to the programs, et cetera? And, Shelby has been active recently and, throughout the years in looking at the programs like E-rate and rural healthcare and trying to suggest ways specifically to the FCC about how these programs can be streamlined, how they could run more efficiently, things like that. A lot of our members are on the ground and they understand the application processes and they're always looking at ways to try to make the programs better. And so, there are certainly ways in which Shelby has suggested that we could streamline and help the processes work a little bit better between USAC and the FCC and the applicants themselves in both the rural healthcare and the E-rate program.
Thank you. Phil or Ray, anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I would say, regardless of the Supreme Court decision, I think we do need to really focus on coming up with some ideas on how to improve. The Government Accountability Office came out with a report last year, said there was over 100 broadband grant programs in the federal government that does not make sense. We need to figure out which ones make sense and which ones don't. I am a firm believer the USF is a really good framework to start with. I think one of the problems is we're taxing grandma who has a landline and no internet access an exorbitant amount, and we're not taxing people that have fiber to the home. To put a finer point on it, I'm going to pull up Rowan County, North Carolina's WAN 471 for the year. Their application for internet is an $840,000 bill, of which $212,000 is USF. We are paying USF to USF recipients, and that is causing the program to look bigger than it is. We pulled the numbers for the current fiscal year, and it looks like USF is paying $54 million a month in taxes and USF fees. That's over a half a billion dollars that's basically going into general funds in states and back into the USF to be accounted in some sort of probably crazy circular loop that wouldn't be legal in the private sector. I think we should look at other funding sources for USF for sure. And I think cybersecurity is definitely worth looking at, whether it should be its own category three, which is what we've been advocating for here at the Friday Institute and have a NPRM comments in on that specific topic, along with a model that shows what it would cost the feds and the locals. And maybe we don't look at calling a school bus a classroom and think about how we can stay in our space, which is classroom internet access should be our priority, and making that secure and safe for kids. I don't agree with the reasons that people are objecting to bus Wi-Fi and hotspots, other than to say we really need to make sure we nail down the schools before we start proliferating our funds outside of the schools and the libraries.
Phil, any thoughts on that topic?
I think that as Kristen pointed out, there are efficiencies that definitely can be applied, I think, in the way USAC works, for instance. I would say on the positive side, right, like there has been, a modernization effort, in 2014, 15 with E-rate. And the as Ray pointed out, the sort of question was called, right, relative to cybersecurity and to what extent it should be added. And even remember, over time, E-rate kind of started as a phone line thing, mostly wireline thing. And after the E-rate modernization order, phone lines are not really an eligible service anymore, right? And so I think that was good. I think cybersecurity being eligible is good. But I think even things like school districts building their own fiber networks and dark fiber and all of that is good. But it sometimes creates situations which were unintended, right? Like there are, when we started school connectivity, the biggest providers were of the WANs were cable companies and phone companies. And now that is not the case. In fact, I would say that neither phone companies nor cable companies are the top providers, certainly in North Carolina. And often the providers are what I would call boutique providers, providers that only provide optical fiber services to schools. And while that seems like a good idea, they displace some incumbent provider who also delivers service to homes. And so then COVID happens, and we worry about not having enough connectivity at home. And the providers in those rural parts of the state say, well, our biggest customer used to be the school district, and we got kicked out by a boutique provider that only provides service to the schools. And so, it's like there are consequences to some of these problems. And so, while it's good to have that choice, it also creates a different problem, right? So, I think that things like that can and perhaps should be addressed moving forward.
Jen, I really appreciate you joining us today. I know that you have a tight schedule and you're running off to one of these meetings to have important conversations about this topic and others that impact your members. But before you go, I wanted to give you the opportunity. There's not an easy fix to all of this, but in a perfect world, what does the future landscape of USF and E-rate look like in your mind?
Oh, that's a good question. In a perfect world, universal service fund programs continue without interruption. And I appreciate the comments and agree that there are still, efficiencies to be gained, and we hope these programs continue to evolve to help support schools, libraries, rural healthcare sites with their technology needs. And we hope that there continues to be bipartisan support for the programs. And should the Supreme Court find that there needs to be changes to the programs, either in part or in full, we hope that Congress acts swiftly to fix those items and minimize disruption to the critical services.
Thank you. And then Kristen, same question for you, right? I mean, where does Shelby fit into this equation? What's her perfect world look like?
So first off, Shelby's overarching message right now is that Congress and the FCC must ensure that the USF is preserved. So we have to recognize that our students and communities cannot excel if they lack access to the internet and online resources. Almost everything we do in modern day society requires an internet connection and knowledge of how to use it. And secondly, in order to help preserve and protect the USF, the fund should be predictable, sustainable, and long-term. Congress and the FCC should strengthen and improve the current contribution system with a modernized approach, right, that helps to broaden the base of funding so that USF can provide lasting support for these essential programs. And conversely, Shelby opposes any efforts that would potentially weaken the fund. I know we've heard proposals that would, potentially subject the USF to congressional appropriations. We think that appropriations is risky for schools and libraries and healthcare providers because anchor institutions need to know that they are able to fund projects each year and how much funding they can receive and how they can respond to personal IT needs and conform to their own district's budget approval processes.
Appreciate that perspective, Kristen, and appreciate the work that you're doing at Shelby as well. And I thought the Shelby Fly-in and the Quill Fly-in were both great events in providing us an opportunity to have these conversations both now and into the future. So I want to close today by saying we've had a great conversation. Really appreciate all of your perspectives and the insights. I want to talk about the future landscape of USF and E-rate. So we've covered this to some extent, right? Technology fundamentally drives the economy, right? So the upcoming USF ruling is a microcosm because it encapsulates broader debates about the balance of power between branches of government, the role of federal agencies, and the fundamental right to access essential services in a digital age. So its outcome will have profound implications for connectivity, equity, opportunity, and the future of telecommunications policy in the United States. It's critical that we continue to make smart investments in technology so we can invent the next internet, the next AI, or the next semiconductor. Those transformational technologies can take years or decades to develop and commercialize. Even a brief pause in investment now creates decades of negative impact and some losses you can't just buy your way out of later. So as we wrap up that discussion today, have time for any final thoughts each of you might have for our listeners.
Sure. I'll reiterate what Kristen said. I think sustainability and predictability are very important, and we do not have that. Every year, we wait for an announcement from the FCC saying whether or not they'll be able to fully fund every request in E-rate or not. And that's kind of never happened that they haven't been able to since modernization, but it's not to say that it couldn't happen. I think it's important that we look at other ways of funding. I can throw out some crazy ideas. Why are spectrum auction funds going to the general fund? Spectrum auction money, first of all, should it be auctioned or should it be leased? Should it be an annual recurring fee for the spectrum? And then that prevents spectrum hoarding and actually puts it to use. That might be an interesting policy change across the FCC to consider. Or how about we charge 0.1 cent for every email? We could end spam immediately if we just started charging for email and generate $1 billion a year. We probably need to be thinking about other ways of getting this fund and putting it to use for the exact reasons you all have been talking about.
Phil, closing thoughts?
Yeah, Jim, I like what you just said a minute ago, the point about, technology moves, right? And so, from the time, not just we started the School Connectivity Initiative, but if you think about from the beginning of the Telecom Act and the advent of USF, like there were no iPhones when that happened, right? There was no cloud. There was no LLM stuff, right? There were, the landscape was very different, right? The telecommunication provider landscape is very different. There's been a lot of consolidation. There's been a lot of change in who the providers are. And, having a program that sort of allows for states and school districts and libraries to manage through the process while knowing that the technology train isn't stopping, right? And the economic train isn't stopping. And then one final point that I'll make is, we talk about this as though, fees started in 1996. It's like, but the truth is, in 1934, when AT&T was created, we were collecting fees. Like for long did like that was the whole point, was that, AT&T was charged a fee, as were then Sprint and MCI, to get access to the local exchange networks, right? So we've been charging fees that have been passing through since the 30s. Now, again, as Ray is also said, I'm not a lawyer, he's not a lawyer, but the mechanics of how we do that through this USAC and so on and so forth, and what actual authority the FCC has, notwithstanding, this notion of having fees, I don't think is a new one. I think, as Ray points out, where the fees come from is really what we should address. And, the internet is a wonderful place, and we all think of it and know of it as a utility. A lot of what we're talking about here, though, is based on the fact that no matter, even though that is true, the internet itself and the protocols that make up the internet and the technologies that are underneath the internet were not built for it to be a utility, right? And so that's, we do the best we can with what we've got. And I think we will continue to do that. And predictability and sustainability would certainly be helpful as we continue to do that.
Well, thank you, Phil. And I am going to go to the attorney on this group today. And I'm going to give Kristen the final word. Anything you'd like to share with our listeners as we wrap up?
Excellent discussion today. I just want to end on a general note here, just to remind our listeners that the Universal Service Fund aims to ensure that all citizens, regardless of location, have access to affordable telecommunications and broadband services. So it really is grounded in the theory that the support it offers is universal. The E-Rate program specifically is a crucial funding source that connects countless schools and libraries to the internet so that students can excel in their educational studies and professional endeavors. Based on the most current data from USAC's 2024 monitoring report, funding year 2023 saw over 100,000 institutions nationwide receive funding commitments from the E-Rate program, with subsidies benefiting rural locations, urban locations, public and private schools. So, needless to say, people nationwide are benefiting from the USF, and it must be protected.
Thank you. Again, I appreciate all of you being here today and sharing your insights. I look forward to continuing our work together as we wait for the ruling and next steps. Thank you for joining us on MCNC Community Connect. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation. Be sure to check out our previous podcast, now available online, and make plans to join us again soon for our next discussion featuring technology leaders and innovators across North Carolina and the nation. You can listen to all episodes of MCNC Community Connect now on www.mcnc.org Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Thank you.